Hello, and welcome to your monthly James Bond podcast, featuring me and my other 00 joining me, Eric Sayor.
You know, I thought Ninjas versus James Bond would be just fan fiction, having not seen this movie maybe ever, maybe in like since I was like 6 years old, but yeah. Ninjas. many ninjas.
so many ninjas.
Yeah. we'll get to the ninjas, but yeah, this is our James Bond podcast, a miniseries licensed to Pod, now with a name. And it was difficult to come out with the right name. I wanted No Time to Podcast, but that doesn't really make sense, as Arlen pointed out.
Because we have so much time to podcast right
now. Enough time to watch 25 movies.
Yeah. And there were other names thrown out, but License to Pod was good. And I was able to do that Photoshop because of it, which I'm so proud of.
If you listen only on Apple Podcast, go to the Sorrow Facebook page and look at the art, because it's very good.
it's very good stuff.
Because Apple Podcast, I don't think changes the
no, the I don't think it does. Art.
Yeah, that's why. I don't get
I think the individual episodes will, though. They might. I'm not positive about that.
Go elsewhere. Go on Spotify. It's there. It rules. Yes. There's my face from like 6 years ago. I don't know when that photo took place. And I was very drunk. And I have very small eyes, almost like James Bond in one of these movies.
It's a good time. It's fun. So if that tells you anything about the tone of this podcast,
we're having fun in these movies. Like I think Sean Connery was having fun.
Most of them.
I feel like he's kind of enjoying himself a lot of the time. Like it shows. But maybe he hates everything and he's just a good actor. That's also possible.
Yeah, I would almost say, and again, I've watched them far more times than you have, so maybe I'm noticing it more. But there are times where I'm like, oh, he does not care. He is so checked out. And then there are the scenes where he's clearly having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I can definitely tell when it's a grumpy Sean or a very happy to drink Siamese vodka Sean. That's something that we'll point out when they come to us, the moments that we think he's having a great time. I think he's having a great time throughout Thunderball. Segue. great when I point him out too. Thunderball.
I mean, considering where they're shooting, I would also be having a good time.
Yes. Yeah.
It's almost brilliant. Surprising he doesn't do the one in the snow. So Thunderball, a movie that has its up and downs, I'd say. I think both these movies I enjoyed, but I wouldn't say are the top of Connery's catalog of Bond films personally. None of the two I liked as much as I did From Russia with Love, which is, I think, the gold standard so far.
Fair. Yeah, this is one that I have usually I've never liked this one, just to start. Like, I've been very against this one in the past, because it's long. It's very, very long. And even though on this viewing, I think I had a very favorable opinion of it after the fact, it still is very, very long, and it doesn't need to be 2 hours and 20 minutes, I think, or 2 hours and 10 minutes. So, yeah, for many reasons. There are a couple couple of things that maybe don't need to be there, such as underwater fight scenes that go on for like 50 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, like way too long. And I think they just like developed the technology and had the cameras and are like, might as well use them. And they probably have like, the director would probably wanted like an hour of that.
Yes. Yeah, it feels like that. He's like, I'm gonna do the biggest. He's the James Cameron of his time.
Yes.
He's doing something nobody else has done. So yeah, he was very excited. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that where there's an opulence to this movie, and it feels like the movies are big, and they know that they're big now. They know that everybody on Earth at the time is watching these movies. I think that's the biggest difference. Where we are now versus those first three movies, where it's still kind of small and they don't know that this is like a giant yeah. hit yet. So they're kind of like, you know, a little ramshackle, and things aren't really that nice looking necessarily all the time. These movies are huge. These feel even more like modern blockbusters, I would say. In certain places, I think that they hit every single time. Like the music, which starts the movie. Fantastic in both of the films we're talking about today.
I think, in general, something you mentioned made me like see these movies very differently that I wouldn't have thought is when you talk about them being like kind of travel logs and like virtual tourism equivalent for the time, because there's so much of that. There's so much of like establishing a place, a lot of establishing shots, a lot of like kind of touristy descriptions of places too. Of trying to get into the culture, but in a very touristy way. It's interesting how much they do that, and how I feel like the modern Bond films don't really have to because of the internet. Like people are a lot more aware about places they can go to, and like you wouldn't get like so much of Japan, or you wouldn't get so much of even Nassau. Just like presented to you just because they're there. I feel
there's certainly less of that time spent on it, but at the same time they do, there's a very good reason that they don't really go to Canada often in the Bond films. They do still often go to exotic looking places. But it's definitely there, and I think it's a positive for a lot of these early Bond films because the Technicolor is so early, so it's very bright and everything just looks very nice. It's very fun. These movies are very escapist, and they do a very good job of presenting that in a fun way. So the plot of this film is interesting.
Thunderball starts and you're at the funeral of a Spectre member, and James Bond tries to console his wife because he's there. She doesn't know we're not supposed to realize that she's not a she. She's the man that James Bond killed, hiding as his own widow. So James Bond basically kills him again.
Yep.
Escapes in like a really good chase. I think I really like that opening thing, because then you get like the car for the one of the first times. You get that Aston Martin chase scene where like with like some water spraying out of it, like definitely like some primitive gadgets, but like still it's all there.
Yeah, it's all there, and that scene is very fun. I had a really good time watching it. That jetpack is cool. That's a great use of the Bond theme. Much better than just him walking through an airport, arguably.
For sure. I don't know, the jetpack waiting for him up was kind of reminded of the scene we talked about in Branded to Kill where the guy jumps out of the window and there's just a balloon there. Yeah. It's just like not very conspicuous, but like if you plan your stuff well, I guess it could work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. This is clearly Bond thinking many, many steps ahead.
And no one being like, why is there a jetpack on the roof of the church?
It's just a jetpack. Maybe he had it airlifted in.
Yes, someone, sometimes a priest has to take a vacation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it'd be fun if, he found the jetpack under a crate, and then, or a box, maybe. That stuff's really good. The entire opening, this is sort of the opening sequence is sort of a thing at this point. A lot of Bond movies have this, where there's an opening sequence that doesn't necessarily play into the larger plot. Yeah. This one doesn't so much. It sort of just sets up Bond going to a rest stop or a restcation or something like that after this. They establish that with M saying, oh, I sent him away there for a little while. I think that's what it.
Yeah, it's not very well established because it feels like just them telling that he's on vacation happens so fast that you don't really realize it because like immediately there's like criminal shit happening so he's taken out of his vacation and has to take matters in his own hands, and by that it means like locking a guy in a machine where he's like, I don't know, relaxing his body to smoke and then almost getting murdered by a machine that like is like a if it's for the spine.
something
like that. Like,
His discs are scrunched up, I guess, or something like that.
It feels like none of the machines that are used in this movie would be used today.
No, they're probably health codes that don't allow some of these things. Some of them are probably dangerous or explode or something like that.
Or just like wreck your body, actually, instead of helping you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is a place where massage, basically. It would be massage, a steam room, maybe, you know. But not this machine that could kill you if it's turned up to 11.
Like, why would you have the speed on the machine?
Yeah, why does it need to go up that high? What
high enough to kill you in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what are you doing with that machine after the fact? Are you using it for drugs or something? Is that what it's for after the fact? After everybody's asleep?
Yeah.
That rest thing is it's a setting for quite a while. But it does bring us into the larger plot of this sort of Spectre swap that they do. They do surgery to make a man look like another man. To swap out the pilot with Count Lippy. Is that who gets swapped? I believe that's the case. But they established Count Lippy at some point. I'm unsure on the names. I think this is why I've never really gotten into this movie, because I was never really sure who anybody was outside of Bond.
There's like Bond and there's number two. And then that's it. Like, that's the characters kind of you care about. There's like, there's a girl, of course, but...
The sort of female evil Spectre agent, who I actually really liked on this time around. She's sort of Bond's equivalent on the other side. And I kind of wish that there was more time with her. I wish she had stuck around a little bit longer. Because she and Connery have a lot of chemistry, I thought, this time around. What did you think about her?
Yeah, I think the way they play off each other and like they're both like I think the scene where she the chase scene and the dance scene where she dies is the best part of the movie. I think there's like this intensity, there's like this it's like kind of messy in a way that you can kind of don't really know where is everyone and all that, like in the way that a lot of movies of that era are. A lot of action movies then. But there's like this intensity, and when they dance together, then you can feel like the chemistry and also the intensity of that scene. And the way she dies kind of sucks.
It does. It would almost be nice if it was like a fake out death and she came back later. And I think in a modern movie she probably would have come back later, and she probably would have killed number two and taken his spot or something.
I think in a modern movie there's a scene before that makes her seem like more violent, and then you don't feel bad where Bond like himself kills her. Like, this doesn't feel like he killed her, it feels like kind of almost an accident.
Yeah.
From how I remember the scene going, like he's maybe even a bit surprised.
Yeah, he is a little bit. He's like, oh, this could have gone either way.
Yeah.
Because he tricks one of her henchmen into getting her. But yeah, I liked that, the idea that Spectre has their own versions of the 00s who are just as skilled, and they have all the gadgets and stuff. And that's something that doesn't really come back for the most part in other movies. The idea that there's sort of an anti-Bond out there, but she's a good counter to him because she's doing a lot of the same things he does. She's being very seductive, and she's using those abilities to undermine him and his mission. I really enjoyed that. She's interesting. Largo is kind of not as intimidating as I feel he should be, mostly when he talks. when he talks, he kind of ruins any intimidation factor that he has. But I think the way he moves is very intimidating, and just everything about the way that he plays on screen, his presence is very heavy. I don't know, what did you think of him?
What I like, I think I like about him is that he's implicated in almost every mission. Like, he goes underwater with the men, and he's like a dangerous fighter underwater, even when you don't know who he is.
Yes.
Which we'll get to.
You have to somehow see him in the goggles and realize his eyes covered up.
Even when it's a stun double, especially, doesn't really work. It's in the world, but double with a different body.
So a much younger man, clearly.
I don't know. I like him. I like how friendly he is.
I do like that.
With Bond, he feels a kind of archetypical. I invite you over. I have those sharks living in my pool. He's kind of a by the book villain. I think he works. He's not intimidating enough to be one of the best. Like, there's no scene where I feel like Bond is directly threatened by him. Like, the scene, the most threatening scene is when he's by himself with the sister, Domino, and he's like, he's about to kill her, and then like Bond shows up and they have their fight, but like, other than that, I don't feel like he's ever a danger. And I think that's maybe a problem of the plot, is that Bond never feels particularly in danger in this movie. It never feels like he's gonna fail.
Like
his enemy doesn't feel smarter than him, not really. And the one that does gets killed almost immediately after they reveal she's a villain.
So they kind of lose a lot of momentum after she goes. The plot slows down a lot, and they start setting up the underwater stuff.
The plot itself, we kind of got sidetracked. But the plot is that they made a man, the brother of Domino, Count Leppi, something Derval is his name.
Somebody got swapped basically, and he crashes a plane carrying nuclear missiles. Yeah.
Count Lepi is the agent that's responsible to replacing Angelo, the NATO pilot, with Derval. Yeah. So the plane they're traveling on has two nuclear bombs. Derval is co-pilot for a second and cuts the air for everyone on the crew. They pass out. He lands the plane underwater. They take the bombs out, and then they hide the plane. Like, number two is the one like waiting for the plane. Kills Derval because he asked for more money. I think they would have killed him either way.
They probably would have, but they definitely were gonna kill him right away.
It kind of it does imply that, like, why don't ask for more money? But I think the real thing is, like, don't do work for a criminal organization just for money, because they're just gonna kill you. They don't care about you.
Yeah, you're just a cog in the machine. They're just gonna take you out. Wait to ask for the money after you're above water, maybe after you're not at the bottom of the ocean. Yeah. He's out.
They ransom the NATO government. So basically, the U.S. and Great Britain for £100 million.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be in pounds because it's a James Bond movie.
Exactly. Yeah.
Even if I feel like if someone stole like NATO, it would be in U.S. dollars, but it's a James Bond movie.
The Empire isn't going anywhere. It's not crumbling under our feet as we know. God save the Queen. Pounds, obviously. That happens. And they take the nukes and they, as we learn later, they hide them in a cave, I guess, somewhere. That's something that's always bothered me. They hide them in a cave and then come back to get them later. So they spend a lot of the movie, I guess, waiting for the moment that they can go back to the cave to retrieve the nukes. I'm not entirely clear on that, but it allows the rest of the plot of the movie to happen for James to get
there. I think it does make sense to an extent, because they have the boat as a distraction so that they would think the nukes are on the boat. Then they have the plane, which is what everyone's looking for. But they're not even on the plane. So even if they find the plane, they don't know where the nukes are. I think for that, there's like a logic there. I just don't think it's clear what happens, because the scene where they do all that is like 5 minutes without a single word underwater. It looks great, but it's not tense. It's not in you don't know who any of these people are. First, because they just all look the same in their wetsuits, and second, because you haven't even been introduced to any of these people yet. You don't know who number two is until like way later, but he's one of the guys that he takes the bombs from the plane and puts them in the cave, and you don't really understand what's going on. That's kind of the problem for me of that of that part.
Yeah, they don't explain why they need to keep it there. They don't really they don't say a lot of stuff, like you said. But we get all the Bond trying to figure out who took it, kind of. He kind of knows, he kind of doesn't.
Bond finds in the file they give to all the double members a picture of like the brother that was getting facial surgery at his like relaxation facility. And I think, the guy that Bond kills there is Count Lepi. I think that's who's that supposed to be. So number four. So he sees in the photo Derval, the replacement pilot, with his sister. They know where the sister is. She's in Nassau in the Bahamas. So that's the lead he's gonna follow. He he inadvertently like, oh, what an accident! I found you in these reefs. Time to seduce you, like every Bond girl so far. Like it feels like it's the immediate same as Dr. No, almost. Like it's like the they've done this like three times already. Like, you kind of know what's going on. Like, oh, hi, you like fishing. I like fishing too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just this time it happens all underwater, and he saves her from getting stuck, so she's a little bit she's into it kind of, I guess, because of that. And then they go on hang out on a beach and stuff, and their romance is, I would actually say, it's pretty good. It doesn't feel like they're too far along. I thought it felt very natural.
Yeah, it feels very natural. Also, it happens throughout the whole movie. Like, it's not a 10-minute thing. It's kind of like the scene in Goldfinger where he like goes up and seduces the mistress in her room, but it's like the whole movie.
Right. Yeah, and it's given time to breathe, and she slowly is more and more into him as it goes along, to the point where she's helping him in the last section.
Yeah, at the end, he finds the plane and finds, like, the dog tags of her brother, shows them to her, tells her, like, that number two, her I don't know.
Her guardian?
Like, your guardian? Yeah. Her, like, her fake uncle... lover thing, like,
something. Yeah. It's very unclear what his actual relationship is, but like, he's her. Yeah,
something. She's his mistress.
Yeah. It's very, I think it's intentionally left vague.
She's like eye candy on his arm. That's like her job.
Yeah, basically. So yeah, she goes sort of undercover to help him using one of this gadget. I think that Q gives him. It's a camera that takes what is it, infrared photos or something? I can't.
Yeah, it takes both infrared photos and also it measures like radiation.
Yes, that's right. It's a Geiger counter as well. So yeah.
We get some more Felix. They find where the plane is. I don't know. It's like by the book. Other than that, and then at the end, big climb. No, you have two climaxes. You have the middle one.
Yeah.
Where then you get like they have those meetings. Number two and Bond like go back and forth. Who's the most macho of the two? More or less.
You're using a woman's gun, he says, or something.
Yeah. And then the woman killer of Spectre, Agent 13.
Fiona Volpe.
Exactly. Fiona Volpe, played by Luciana Paluzzi. She gets there, Strix Bond. Basically, kidnaps his assistant. Like he sent, he has like a, yeah. He has like a second in command with him. She gets kidnapped by this woman and killed. Bond is like kind of captured, escapes. They fight throughout the city. He managed to escape her. Runs out through the carnival, like there's the big the Nassau equivalent to Mardi Gras, so like a huge carnival, everyone in costume, a big cultural event that feels like very like okay, time for the touristy thing to happen. The big action scenes during the most touristy thing possible. And then they have like their big climactic moment where he's like, he's surrounded in the bar. She's like, okay, let's dance, basically. They dance together. Someone hidden behind like a curtain shoots at both of them. She's the one that gets a bullet, she dies. And we lose like the movie's best character, basically.
It's a little rudderless from here. Every scene without Sean, really, it's kind of boring if he's not on screen. it's interesting, but it does go, and it does, things do happen. like I said, it gets a little bit cloudy after she dies, I think. But he, he swims through the pool of sharks, which is, I feel like that scene must have been very tense when this movie first came out. It's not so much now. At least that's how I felt about it. Because they're such small sharks, I think Jaws coming out kind of killed it.
Yeah, they're kind of small sharks. I feel like these sharks wouldn't attack a human. I don't know. Maybe.
If they're like really hungry, they might come in for a chomp, but like they're not gonna like go after you. My understanding is that sharks like this, especially, they're kind of like dogs, so it's not that hard to get them off of you. Or avoid them, really. So yeah, the shark's not really that threatening. I can see why they might have been back then at the time. And then what else happens?
The big ending of the film is like Spectre's plan is to take the money but also use the bombs in Miami. Bond intercepts, saved by Felix. They called the U.S. Navy or something. I don't know, like a bunch of CIA agents that get dropped from a plane and go straight underwater, and you have the big underwater fight, where it's like, okay, it's not. I think a common criticism of this scene is that you don't know what's like who's who and all that. I think the biggest criticism is that like, you don't know who number two is. Like, that's the only problem of this scene. It's like, you need like Bond has a distinct costume. Like, the good guys and the bad guys have different color costumes, but like him, he should have one too. Like, you should be able to like know it's him just by looking at him. And I think that's like both like the editing's, it's both editing and costuming, I think. It doesn't feel like smart. It doesn't feel smart that he that he would have like a different color thing, but also like he should have like, they should cut him in the beginning and then you know immediately that it's him.
Sure.
There should be some visual thing.
Yeah, well, like his Spectre people, they have these like propellers that they're driving around. He should have one, but it's like a little bit bigger. And it's like red or something, you know. It should be like it should be something that indicates he's the sort of the leader of them. Something like that I think would be helpful. And I'm actually into this underwater sequence up until the reinforcements come. I think that's maybe the most tense, because it's just Bond sort of infiltrating them, and when he gets found out, I thought that scene was pretty effective. I like that this is a thing that he does in every movie, where he's the bad guy, and they keep on getting like smarter and smarter. So by the time we get to the next movie, Blofeld is immediately like, "No, stop that man from getting in there." Largo is just a little bit slower on the uptake. Up until that big battle sequence, I'm into it, and then the battle sequence happens, and it's still unbroken. We haven't actually seen Sean Connery say words in, like, 30 minutes or so, and it's a lot of just...
It goes on for so long. I think, like, there's 20 people and, like, 40 people die in that scene.
Something like that.
If you count the number of people that die and the number of people at the beginning on either side... It doesn't even make sense. Like, not even close.
I'm pretty sure there were more people on the good side at the end than there were at the beginning. Yeah.
it's really funny. I think, but my favorite moment of the whole thing, I think, is like, sharks show up and then everyone starts freaking out at the same time. It's very good. I think that's like the smartest thing they do in that whole fight scene. It's like, It like makes more sense than everything else that was happening until then.
that's what's good. And I do like the way that they kill some of the bad guys. Like, Bond tricks them into going into a boat and then he blows up the boat. Like, some of that stuff is fun, and it breaks up just, again, people swimming at each other and shooting spears. Yeah. And because it's underwater, everything is happening so slowly. I think that's why it's so noticeable.
How many times can Bond like cut with a knife the tube from the gas tank to the mouth?
Yeah.
like 6 times, 7 times.
Yeah, it's a lot like Iron Man smashing through robots and Ultron. Just like, okay, we get it. He can smash the robots. He can punch the robots. Yeah. Okay, can we watch something else now? But yeah, Sean's just doing it. Just over and over again.
It does kind of make me want like a real good like John Wick action scene underwater. Like, I want to see like how you can do like one of those well, because I doing underwater scenes is very hard. Like good ones, the Mission Impossible one in Rogue Nation we talked about, it rules. It's super intense.
There's a
great
one later on in this series that's really good. I think in Skyfall there's an underwater sort of fight sequence that's very good and it's very visceral. And I think that clearly they had a lot of time to learn the lessons of this one, I think.
Yes. Yeah, I think a lot of this also is like showing off the technology. I don't know how many movies were shot so beautifully underwater, because this looks like, throughout the whole movie, it looks so beautiful. It just makes me want to go to the beach and go to the Bahamas.
the water looks great. Yeah. Everything looks great.
Yeah, having been to the Caribbean, it's like, oh yeah, just take me back there.
It'd be great. You mentioned Felix. Since we've had a few Felixes now, where would you rank the Felixes? Because this guy's up, I think he's up there for me.
I think that's my favorite guy. Like, I love his introduction. He like, you kind of you don't know who that is, which is, I think, is good about Felix, is that like, because he's a different guy in every movie, a different actor, it's like, you don't necessarily suspect that that's him.
Mm-hmm.
So the introduction is, you're like, okay, he's been following Bond, and then he knocks on the door and is about to say something, and Bond punches him in the face, but just to keep him from talking because there's a killer in the bathroom.
It's really
good. Yeah, that like switch is super good.
Yeah, and I like that he has a lot of characterization, and he's not as like, I don't know, unhelpful as the guy from Goldfinger. He's probably my least favorite Felix that we've revisited so far.
I kind of like that. I like him in like a bumbling way. Like, he's
right. He's very laid back, and he's very like, whatever, man.
I think I think like this Felix is the best, then Dr. No, then Goldfinger, but also all Felixes are good.
Felix is great. More Felix. I think we can agree on that. More Felix.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think.
The Thunderball song. What did you think? What did you think about the Thunderball?
Honestly, at this point, thinking about it and knowing the songs that we have up ahead of us, this might be my favorite Bond opening song.
Oh,
possibly.
Nice.
Definitely my favorite of the Connery songs. I think it's everything that I want a Bond song to be, even more so than Goldfinger. Just because it's so big and so bombastic. And I think it matches what they were going for with this movie, what I think they wanted this movie to be. And it kind of sells you on a better movie than you get, which is what some of the better Bond songs do. They make you think you're going to watch a really great movie. I would put this high up there for me. What do you think of Thunderball?
Yeah, I like it. I put it as the same level as Goldfinger. I think they're similarly good. I do retroactively really like From Russia with Love. Even though it's not like, it doesn't have that staple feel, I just really like that song, I think.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder, I mean, if they could go back, they would probably put the lyrics in the opening. I think they just weren't sure what they were doing yet. I would love to know what it would look like, though, if they had done that, if they had gone with the lyrics and done a bigger, sort of more bombastic version of that song. Because I think that would be up there for me. but because of the way it's used in the movie, it's so low key that it doesn't necessarily register for me as much. Whereas when I think of Bond, I do think of Thunderball. Like this song like comes up in my head when Bond in the wider world.
Just because I'm just not that much of a old Bond fan, my Bond song is Skyfall, probably like the one that I think about immediately, and that's like perfect in my mind.
Let's see. The Spectre stuff in this movie is really good. Just the larger organization stuff and like the world building around Spectre. They're like covert office that they have hiding behind a charity for helping people get reassigned to other countries, I think. I think that's what they're doing. Basically, they're helping people in third world countries, I assume, get to Western countries or something to that effect. It's very in the background there, and you kind of have to be looking for it. But that's what they're doing as the front for that big boardroom where we see Blofeld a little bit more, and we establish him. And yeah, that seems really good. It's the Austin Powers thing that
gets
copied. but here it's actually played very seriously, and I around
I still really love that 60s technology aesthetic. That like everything feels like everything looks like a set, really, but like it's good. Like I just love that look.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to remember the name of the designer, but yeah, Ken. I think I can't remember his name, but yeah, his design is really good. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, this is the second movie directed by Terrence Young that did From Russia with Love. I think there's like I feel like the great stuff in both those movies like ring similarly. Like he knows how to use Connery, I think, really well. But yeah, it feels like in this movie he's like, I got a real bigger budget and I can try things in a completely different setting that I've probably ever done before, so
Yeah, it feels like he got a bigger chest of toys to play with in this movie, and he does use it really well for the most part. Let's see, is there anything else I really wanted to go into? Connery, obviously, like we've kind of talked about him a little bit. I think he does a really good job in this one. He's playing the character. He's doing a very good job. He's very settled. I do think for the most part he is kind of happy in this movie. Like I mentioned earlier, I don't know if he's really that jaded at this point. I think he's jaded a little bit more in our next movie. But I think he's having a good time for the most part at this
Yeah, time. I think in this movie he's on the beach, and in the next movie they do some weird things with his face.
To put it lightly.
I think that's a good point to move on to. You Only Live Twice. The movie that has the most interesting credit in all the movies we've watched so far. It was written by Roald Dahl, I did not expect while watching the credits. I had to look it up immediately to make sure that
you know the behind the scenes.
I don't know anything.
Okay, so the reason why Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming were like besties in real life, and at one point they were talking about adapting movies, and a trade was proposed, where Ian Fleming would write the script for Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which was a Roald Dahl book, of course, and Roald would write an adaptation of whatever the next Bond movie was that was coming up, and he picked this one. That's why that happened. And it's very interesting, because I don't think Roald Dahl really ever did anything of this scale or size ever again. And I don't really think he worked on many movies in general, not that weren't adaptations of his
own. And even his adaptations, I feel like he's not like where I don't think he did any screenplays specifically for his adaptations.
Not that I can think of. No.
Yeah.
I'm looking at him right now. But yeah, he didn't. He just wasn't a screenwriter for the most part. So it is weird that he did that. Yeah, like looking at it, he did. He was part of the screenplay for Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. That's about it, really. Everything else is a story credit, as would be expected.
Think even that was completely, it says here, was completely rewritten because he didn't meet the deadlines. And he hated the film.
That makes sense. That checks out. It's a very interesting movie. For that, I guess partially because of that. But it does feel like a Bond movie. It feels like the machine is there, so even if it is Roald Dahl, he can't really mess up too much. And I guess this is sort of a way to talk about how these movies precede Marvel, and I brought that up, I think, in the last episode a little bit. But I think that in the same way that Marvel movies reached a point where they could only go so low and be so bad in some ways, I think Bond is getting there too, where their lows can only go so far for the most part, at least at this point, because they're just doing them so consistently. And I think that they figured out how to make these movies and how to adapt these stories in a compelling way at this point.
I want to get to the real bad ones. I hope there's some, because
they are coming. They are happening. We'll talk about them.
Yeah, because these feel like, at this point they reach kind of a right place. I think I really like the first half of this one. I think all the setup is real, real great. And I think the ending feels like a huge, like, not action, half action scene, half like real racist shit, and half like a big infiltration scene. That, like, the set piece is not as good, I think, as the first half. All the setup, all the corporate spy stuff, I think all that is like feels real closer to like the most recent Bond films. Like, it feels really modern in a way that you like he fakes to be like the leader of a company dealing with another leader, and like company, like Spectre hiding behind Japanese businesses and all that. I think all that stuff is really good.
I like all the setup of that. It's very strong, and the supporting characters for the most part are also, they're all interesting. Tiger Tanaka is great for the most part. I like all of this, really. I like the whole Bond dying at the beginning, but it feels like he does that all the time. But I really like the setup of that. I like that the Hong Kong police are like, he would have liked it this way. he's so unanimous with being a dog that the Hong Kong police know it already. Assuming that they're not MI6 guys, but come on. Who knows? That's really fun. Since we sort of ended on the song a little bit with Thunderball, what do you think of the song for this one?
I think it's not there. it's just like, it's one of those, like, the most least interesting song I think so far.
Yeah, it's very mellow, and the opening, the actual titles are the worst part, because they're very uninspired. It's the same symbol over and over again, over admittedly like very nice imagery, I would say, the volcanoes and all that, like, that's kind of cool.
Yeah,
but it's the same thing over and over again with names and like different colors compared to some of these other Bond movies, where it's the title sequences can be broken down almost as like a piece of art on their own. This feels kind of lazy, and then the song does nothing to help any of that. And it's just very mellow. It's not quite the opening that I would want, If this was like the song at the end of a Bond movie, I think it would work better. It's not on all cylinders for me though. So yeah, glad we're kind of synchronistic on that.
Especially like just listening now before the show to both the songs, Thunderball is so much better than this. So I like the setup also of the movie. It's like the first scene immediately is like you see a spacecraft being eaten by a larger spacecraft.
Yes. Yes, it's very good.
So the plan here, Spectre's plan here, is to start ignite the Cold War and start an all-out war between the U.S. and the Russians, the USSR, by kidnapping basically satellites for both of them by using their own satellite that's bigger and that can eat. Like,
right.
It has a kind of it looks like a kind of a worm with a weird like mouth that opens and closes around, and so Bond travels to Japan. Bond fakes his death, then travels to Japan to find out like what is happening there. I don't remember like what leads him there.
He's just sent there. They fake his death because they think that will help, even though Spectre knows who he is by this point.
Yeah.
They fake his death so that he can be somebody else. I can't actually remember the
fake. It doesn't really help that he says his name to basically anyone that asks.
Yeah, basically. He does not care at all. He goes there. He meets the head or the guy that MI6 has there, who is someone we're going to see again. Charles Gray, who plays Henderson, the first weeaboo. who has lived there half his life. As he says, I think half of his house is Western, half of his house is Eastern. Sure, why not? Live your best life, buddy. Live your best life.
He's like the equivalent of like guys that go to Japan now to teach English because they love anime.
yep, exactly, 100%. He's the forefather of that of that movement. But he's having a good time, and then he gets killed by someone stabbing him in the back. And Sean immediately chases after them. He gets into the car, pretends to be the guy who stabbed Charles Gray, and he's driven back to the base of operations for this company by The Rock's grandfather, actually. Just a little bit of trivia. That's something that happens. And they do fight at one point, so that's kind of cool. That sequence is really good. I really like that company, and their design is interesting. Like I said, the design all around. And that leads him to getting this picture and a micro dot that's inside of it, which he brings to Tiger Tanaka. And Tiger is just instantly the coolest
character in all of James Bond put together, like the head of Japanese espionage, SIS
police, I think, something like that. He tricks people that he likes and he doesn't like into going on a slide that goes into his office, and then he has his own private train. Like I said, just the coolest. Later on, he just reveals that he has a secret ninja trading camp, because why not? But he does a lot of setup and gives you a sense of who the people are, who the head of that company is. Osato, I think it's called. A lot of this movie is copied for the plot of The Wolverine years down the road. And I realize that more and more this, like, it's very clear that the director Mangold. Of that, James, yeah, Mangold, that he must really love this movie, because a lot of things are just copied verbatim. The only thing that doesn't happen is Hugh Jackman does not join a clan of ninjas or try to turn himself Japanese.
I think part of it is that, and I think part of it is also there's like a direct inspiration of Japanese movies of the 50s in this movie.
Yeah.
Like the second half especially is like, yeah, we watch a bunch of Japanese movies that were great and like let's try to do the same. It's not all there, but yes. Yeah, Japanese movies that take place like 500 years ago, let's act as if like that was like Japan now.
Yes. Yeah. That's the thing though. They're doing a thing. They're definitely going for like big and sort of an encapsulation of the places that they're setting these movies. And I think that if Nassau had its own particular film culture, the way that Japan has, they might have done a thing. But they just did it for Japan, I guess. So yeah, there's a lot of that in there. I'm trying to think of any of the major plot things that we need to really go into.
They know that the base is close to a certain location. Before heading there, Bon is taking to Tiger Tanaka's ninja facility, where you get the return of like background training that looks completely insane and is not commented on, which is one of my favorite things in these early James Bond movies.
Yes,
but like great. This is like way closer to like the ridiculousness of like the Spectre thing, but even pushed to an extreme, because they're doing ninja training, like they're breaking blocks of ice with their heads, which I had a I had a karate professor who did this in like as part of shows. Like he used to break like 16 blocks of ice one after the other, like 1 foot, 1 foot by 1 foot of depth each, and just like break them one after the other. So weird trivia fact about my old karate professor.
It works. Yeah.
Yeah, they do, but like they fight with swords, they throw shuriken, all the stuff, and then Tiger Tanaka says the most important part of the movie, and to before going to the island, you must do three things. You must first you must become a ninja, then you need to become one of us, and third, you need to take a wife.
Yeah.
So you get Bond training to be a ninja, fighting with swords. at least there's no like ninjutsu.
Yeah.
But it's almost there. Like it's a level of weeb that's kind of feels like a comedy today, and I don't know how it played then. I'm very curious, because I feel like in the 60s, like British people had no idea about like how people lived in Japan, and like or even in the US, I feel like the cultural only cultural knowledge of Japan at the time is probably just like like post-war, like Kurosawa films.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And Godzilla, basically.
Like, yeah, exactly.
It's a very small amount that people actually know about Japan at this point, I feel. So they're like I said, they're compressing a lot of things.
And even like U.S. media portrayal of Japan is probably only kamikaze, and that's it. So like a skewed version for a skewed vision for sure, and a kind of racist vision that you get in this movie. Like there's a lot of like orientalism. I think even the song at the movie song feels like it's like westernized interpretation of like oriental Japanese like culture,
yeah,
in a way. Like it's like westernized Japanese westernized, like cliche, the most cliche possible Japanese music.
Yeah, they're one step away from doing the like they're one step away from that.
And you're not allowed to do that unless you have like Jackie Chan in your movie. That's the only time you're allowed to, because at least he'll make it funny. that's the rule with this thing. Anyway,
coming in to help you.
So then to become Japanese, they fuck up his face and make him like I don't know.
They put Spock makeup on him, kind of. I guess, like, I didn't notice it. That's other than in the surgery scene, I didn't notice that anything had changed. He just looked like Sean Connery with a different haircut. It's a weird decision.
It's like awful. Like it's like it's not. It's indescribable. Like, why would you think to do that? It makes no sense.
Like, it'd be better if he came in. I mean, this is now with modern day context. It'd be better if he came to the island like as a person under heavy makeup, like somebody who went through a bad accident or something. Like, that would be more convincing, because the problem is he's Sean Connery. So he's like a foot and a half taller than everybody else. So even if we accept that the makeup kind of made him look Asian, which it doesn't, he still is a giant. He's a giant man who you have to like squeeze him into frame sometimes. So it just doesn't work. People would notice, oh, he's much taller than just about everybody else near him or around him. I wonder if that man's actually a white man. It's not convincing at all. It's a very strange decision. And I'm shocked that they weren't questioning it even then. Because again, some little behind the scenes stuff, he had problems like finding privacy in real life because Japanese loved the James Bond movies and they loved him. And there were people sneaking into the bathroom to take pictures of him. It's a very strange choice that I don't understand, and I think that maybe they shouldn't have made it then. He maybe should have just come in and they'd done an assault on the island and cut like 30 minutes out of this movie that we really don't to establish another Bond girl. She's not bad, but we don't need her necessarily.
Oh yeah, no, you get Aki, who you get introduced to, and she rules. I think she's like a really good addition at the beginning. They have good chemistry, and they kill her, and like 5 minutes later, not even replace her immediately with a character called Kissy Suzuki.
Yes.
Who's also voiced by like a white woman.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in these movies. Tiger's voiced by a white man. Also, both of the Bond girls in this, or the Japanese Bond girls in this, they're both in Godzilla films. Not surprising to anybody, I'm sure, but just something I wanted to point out. And they're both in the same one. They are in Ghidorah, the Three-Headed Monster, I think. It's either that one, or it's one of the ones that we talked about on the show before. But they share one film beforehand. We don't need both of them. And they introduce her by like nagging her, kind of. They're like, she has the face of a pig, and then she shows up, it's like,
oh yeah. And then you have the face reveal, which you have like you see women one after the other who is like, is this the wife? Is this the wife? Is this the wife? It's like, why are you doing all that? It sucks. Why is this whole ceremony happening? It makes no it helps nothing for the plot. It doesn't feel like spy things. It feels like the opposite. And also, as like a adaptation of like the character she plays has a name because the character in the book has a name and is like way more important. Like Kissy Suzuki is the only has a child with James Bond in the book. She's like a way more important character, and in the movie, right. Like she doesn't even have a last name in the credits. So, I don't know. I feel like killing Aki serves no purpose other than having another attractive Asian woman in your movie. And I don't know, movie would work way better just with Aki, I think.
You don't need it. You don't need the infiltration scene or just have him assault the base. He just assaults the base. And you can even say, well, they did infiltrate. He's been there for days and he's done it. And we don't need to get into the specifics of how he got there. But then again, the travel log of it, I guess. I think that was, if I had to guess, that's the reason I kept it. Like they wanted to show the Japanese mountains and all that stuff.
Yeah, the Japanese mountains and the culture aspect of the thing. There's a funeral when they get to the island. It's very like Discovery Channel travel log of them. They find the base, that the base is on the volcano. Bond infiltrates it. Kissy is sent out to let Tiger and his ninjas know to come attack the base. Bond infiltrates, frees some American astronauts, tries to sneak onto the spaceship. Why he does it himself and not ask one of the professional astronauts that he frees to do it in his stead, who knows?
he's got a scrapbook and events that he's got to mark off, and it's on the list of things that he wants to do. He wants to go to space. Little does he know. These things are going to happen for him later on.
They will.
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, Blofeld, of course, immediately is like, stop that man. He's far too tall to be an astronaut. Since I brought him up, what do you think of Donald Pleasance as our first on-screen faced Blofeld?
I like him, he's good. I think he's like the best villain so far.
I would say he's got the most presence of most of the villains.
I think Goldfinger sucks. I think Dr. No is okay. He's the best villain so far.
Unless we're giving Grant like double status.
He's not the. Yeah, he's more like a. He's like the Bond opposite. Like the woman in Thunderball, like is more like James Bond opposites. And I think those characters are more interesting interacting with Bond than supervillains.
Yeah,
when they have someone that's like as good and as smart as him, instead of like a just like. I have the power of an organization, which Blofeld has like both. Like he's the one that spots that it's Bond. And I like that. I'd like he's the smartest man there, and he's like a good like Bond is a foil to him, but he's also a good foil to Bond. Donald Pleasance is also a really good actor. We've talked about him before on this show.
Yeah, he does a lot with very little. He doesn't have actually very many this time around, but he plays them. He plays them really big and really broad, but it's fun. it's very fun.
Yeah, I think going from sharks to piranhas is an upgrade. number two to number one.
Yeah.
You don't even have to see the piranhas. You just can just like see some water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it goes on this thing of he's not afraid to, like, kill his own people, which is something that's sort of been slowly established. But I like that that's a consistent aspect of that character. He's ready to just, like, dispense of people who he thinks messes up. And also, upon rewatch, he does do, like, the double fake-out a lot. And I'm usually convinced that he's going to kill the other person, even when I know it's when it's not going to be that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's really good. We learned that the government of Japan hired them to start this war because, I guess, the government of Japan thinks that they'll come out on top in some way. Which I guess that would be the case. I guess if they're not involved, they would probably come out pretty well.
The U.S. being in a worse situation at the time, the U.S. being responsible for most of the sanctions post-World War II, not responsible, but actually being the one that wants them and applies them. Mm. I guess there's, like, some form of logic there. I think that whole plot is real good. The stealing and the Cold War, and I think both the movies we talked about have, like, interesting plots. Execution is again up and down.
Yes,
and then you get, like, a Kissy comes back, and there's an army of against Blofeld and his men, and
yeah,
it goes on for like 30 minutes, and
yeah, because they keep getting in and then getting shot at and then getting in and getting stuck and so on. It's not as well handled as it could be. It could be more exciting. But I do think once they get in officially, it's somewhat better. I like the Blofeld just locks himself in a room. That's a very gangster move from Blofeld. There's a lot of, like, well, now I'm winning type of stuff going on. Well, you didn't know that I had, you know, gas or something like that. But it, I think it goes on for a little bit long, not as badly as the underwater stuff from Thunderball, but it could be condensed a little bit. But I think a lot of the end of this movie could be condensed. These two movies suffer from sort of an unofficial Bond rule, which is that every Bond movie is maybe 10 minutes too long, or 10 minutes too short, depending on the movie. And I think that this one does have that just a little bit. It could be a little bit more condensed and a little bit less.
And I think a lot of it tends to be at the end, and it has maybe it's a bit of the Marvel problem, even of having a huge action scene at the end to make it worth their popcorn to the people watching it. And, like, I don't know, those scenes, once you've seen a few, you've seen them all.
Right.
It's rare that you're going to get surprised by the big action scene at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're more likely to be surprised by something character-based or something to that effect.
Or even, like, smaller set pieces that are, like, more, they try less for spectacle, but they do more in terms of, like, tension.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm excited to talk about the movie next time, because I think it does a lot of those set pieces way better, and way tighter. And even if it's the longest of those movies we've talked about so far, I think it feels way tighter than. Anyway, we'll get to it. We'll get to it. Anything else?
I'm looking at it. Let's see. So we kind of talked about it, most of the stuff. Sean is a little bit bored in some part of this movie. But again, for the most part, he's still having fun, I think. But there are scenes where it does seem a little bit checked out. Mostly just, like, basic setup stuff, though, where it's just, like, him standing there walking down a Japanese street. Some of that stuff I don't think he feels that comfortable. But anytime he has to do something exciting, for something fun. I think he's having a good time. He's having a great time trying to break into that safe, I thought. That scene, like, there's a lot of tense stuff in this movie. And that's the best stuff. I think the bigger action sequence stuff just doesn't hold up as well. Because it's been sort of done. Like, other movies have done it and done similar sequences, and they've done them better and tighter, both in this series and in other film series, where there's just, like, a big action set piece like this. Let's see. I do like the Little Nelly sequence quite a bit. I don't know, what did you think of that sequence? Did you think it was fun, or did you think it was kind of silly? Or
sorry, which sequence? Wrong? The Little Nelly.
It's the helicopter. The James's helicopter that Q brings him, and Q is very upset that he has to go all the way to Japan to
live. Oh yeah, this rules. I love this part.
It's so good.
Yeah. You know, it's I really like that scene where he's exploring on his tiny helicopter. It feels direct companion piece to Mad Max, the World Warrior.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it made me think of that. When I was watching, I was like, oh, interesting. I feel like that's probably the inspiration for that helicopter. But yeah, and again, Q, he is not happy. Q coming out into the field and being like just not excited at all to be there because he hates traveling. That's my favorite thing. Just Desmond Llewellyn complaining like an old grandpa who doesn't want to. Always great.
Yeah.
I get excited for it every time. And he's especially like, I don't have it for you, James. I'm not into this. Get the fuck away from me. He has that energy, and see.
And you get a scene also in this movie that is maybe the direct inspiration for a Fast 9 scene of a car chasing James Bond and like being picked up by a helicopter with a magnet.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I think also rules. I love like 60s big special effects like this. I think the movie doesn't show its age when it does, like, the car parts, the car chases, the helicopter chase, also really good.
Yeah.
Overall, I think all that, all those action scenes, really good. A lot of good chase scenes in the beginning, a lot of, like, running around in a room, like...
The stuff on the roof of the docks, that stuff's really good.
Great helicopter shots that look really incredible. Overall, like, I really like that first hour. I think it feels like the thing that like I said at the beginning, it's like feels close to like modern Bond in a way that you don't get the huge set piece where like there's like a 50 agents against 50 agents in those modern movies, but you get like that kind of chase scenes and that kind of like just talking to the leader of a company and going around like the subject you both know is going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's sort of a Hitchcockian thing in the beginning of this movie and in the later movie. It's, you know, who knows what and does he know who he is, sort of thing. Yeah, that's just really good. Something I didn't say at the beginning of talking about this one. This one's always kind of been a favorite of mine, of the later Connery stuff. It's one that I rewatch a lot. I'll usually watch From Russia with Love, and then I'll watch this one. They kind of go together for me. But at the same time, I think I've always had the same problems with it.
Yeah.
Of course, as I think I said in the first episode, I am trying to be a little bit more critical this watch through. A lot of that stuff it definitely showed in this one.
It is a movie that feels very watchable, way more than Thunderball. I think like it has a better pacing, and they both have that problem that when you spend too long without hearing Sean Connery talk, you're kind of bored.
When he's not there, he does a lot of the energy does seem to go away.
Like, and even if it's just like shooting and fighting, like especially those big fight scenes, like they get boring without like the quips and the more character moments. I think that's it for me on this one. It's Lewis Gilbert's first directed movie as first James Bond film. He's like a very prominent director that directed like 30 or 40 movies you never heard about. and like three Bond films. So we'll get back to him later. Yeah. But good first Bond
to your
film.
Reactions. Yeah, I look forward to your reactions to his other two. And I can't wait for you to watch the opening scene of both of them and find the very familiar. fun. One last thing, sort of not to go too far back to Thunderball. The Skyhook from Batman, or from The Dark Knight, happened at the very end of that movie, which is something that is very interesting to see, and I always forget about. It just happens at the very end. They get saved by the hook. It's very clear that Christopher Nolan saw that as a child and put that in a movie someday. Yeah.
It stayed somewhere in his mind for years.
Yes. And that's the other thing. He's a huge Bond fan, and he's been circling doing a Bond movie for years. And you can see it. And I'd be curious to see what you would think of going back to his Nolan trilogy and noticing all the Bond-isms. There's a lot of Bond in Inception as well, especially in the we talk about it here very shortly in another episode.
Yeah, no, Inception is definitely like... the work of someone that spent that had way too many dreams of Bond movies.
yes, somebody who had a lot of
Who watched those obsessively and then dreamed about them and like, what if I put those two together?
Yes. What if I put all my favorite Bond sequences into one film? Let's see. I think that's good. We can do the final thing, which is of these two, should people watch either of them? And then are there sort of standout scenes in either film?
Yeah, I'd say if there's, you have to watch one, You Only Live Twice, I think, for me, is the one. I think Thunderball is maybe also worth watching. Like, if you enjoy watching Sean Connery as Bond, I think it's like a good Bond Connery film. I think out of the five we watch, I think it's like the middle one, like that and Dr. No. Goldfinger is the bottom for me, and I think the parts I dislike in From Russia with Love, I care less about than the part I dislike in this movie. Like, From Russia with Love, you cut out, like, that 15 minutes in the middle. It's, like, great. This, I feel like it is more like the second half feels a lot more messy and... kind of... It feels, again, like a director building a huge set and trying to use it to the maximum of, like, what they can do, and it's a bit too much.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. I would say, I would definitely agree, watch You Only Live Twice if you're definitely going to watch one. Watch that one. Maybe on Thunderball. Thunderball, my standout scene would actually be the underwater fight that we talked about.
Yeah.
Just so you have context for it, like as a thing to talk about in conversation when people are talking about Bond, knowing that that scene exists and having a frame of reference for how long it goes and the problems with it and the things about it that are kind of cool. I think that's worth your time. If I had like a standout scene for somebody who was just going to skip this one no matter what, I would maybe watch all the volcano stuff. Or the Little Nelly action sequence. One or the other.
I think that helicopter chase. Well, I'd say watch the helicopter chase and watch the ninja scene because it's ridiculous. It's like the introduction to the ninja base. It's like so much going on. I think it's just worth watching.
And the volcano set is fun because of the Austin Powers of it all. Like, you can know what that joke is. You can understand the joke more thoroughly than just, you know, having seen the movie.
From Thunderball, I think watch the opening. That's a really good opening. Also, like we said, I said before, the dancing scene, the chase during the carnival plus the dancing scene. It's pretty good.
And maybe there's a supercut of Volpe. That would actually be
worth
because she's great. That sequence where she's driving him back to his hotel.
Oh yes, we didn't talk about that. She's going 90 miles per hour, and he's like freaking out, but trying his best not to show it. But like there's not a lot of scenes where he get a chance to like act and do things. Like act like he's out of his comfort zone, because that's not the character, but that's a scene where he feels like scared actually. Which really good. I think he plays really well. I think it's a great moment.
And then you sort of gave your ranking. I've of course had not a ranking, but like a tier system for how I think of these movies. You Only Live Twice has sort of stayed where it was. But in my actual, like, Google Notes thing that I have, I did move Thunderball from watchable to above watchable, as I've labeled at the moment. There was a time where I had it in a category watchable trash, which is a category we're going to be visiting very soon. Very, very soon. Look forward to that. I think that's the show.
Small quick plugs. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Isayer. Follow Losara on Facebook. If you can't see it on your player, go look up the art for the miniseries. It's worth your time.
Yes, please do. Phantom Zone podcast, of course. We're getting to kind of a regular schedule because of this quarantine. It's kind of allowed it. Look forward to an After Dark coming out very soon with Andy Sites. I always get that wrong. I'm sorry, Andy. I'm sorry. Listen to that. Listen to news episode that I think will be on all the podcast players and RSS stuff by the time this is out. Look forward to that. I think we're recording a movie special that I might have already talked about in another episode, so that should be out very soon as well. All that stuff, go listen to it. And this has been your license to pod.
As always,
we're gonna laugh before we even get to it.
Success.